Dit was een leuke Iers 1-2'tje. Eerst draaiden we I Dreamed a Dream, afkomstig uit het zuidelijk gelegen Cork, met daarna gevolgd door Nerves, een band uit het meer noordelijk gelegen Foxford. Voor te borduren op het succes van hun vorig jaar verschenen EP Glorach, keert de band terug met het rauw klinkende Dirty Fingers. En voor deze nieuwe single werkte ze opnieuw samen met de producer Daniel Fox van de Killa Band. En die invloed, die hoor je wel. In onze wekelijkse zoektocht naar plaatjes voor dit programma kwamen we deze week op Bandcamp toevallig uit bij een EP van Dive Tank. Die EP heet Vermin en de groep komt uit Calgary. Eigenlijk kunnen we zelfs niet zeggen of het een groep of een eenmansproject is, want een redelijk lange zoektocht bracht ons wel langs allerlei duikmateriaal en vergif, maar leverde ons dus geen extra info op. Maar dit komt wel uit die EP die begin oktober vorig jaar uitkwam, het Hot Dogs All Dressed van Dive Tank.
Cut. The way they beat us is such a joke. could call me a small business owner, living in America while trapped in the body of an operatic diva. I'm such a soprano. Shit, will I settle? If we migrate, you can get the next one. I'll be back in a sec, but I'm grateful. It was worth it, skipping my hustle.
Het lijken wel de jaren 90. In aanloop naar een nieuwe plaat verschijnen er tegenwoordig weer massa's singles. Ook al blijft het bij een digitale stream. Voor Model Actress zitten we al aan single nummer 3. En dan weet u volgens de wetten van de muziekindustrie dat de release voor binnenkort is. De plaat verschijnt volgende week, heet Pirouette. En daar zal dus dit nummer op staan, Diva van Model Actress. En dan eentje recht van de vroegmarkt, want u weet, op vrijdag verschijnen alle nieuwe platen. De Duitsers van Web brachten vandaag hun 6e plaat in 7 jaar tijd uit. En net als hun groepsnaam telt de titel van de plaat dubbel, want dat is namelijk Plexus Plexus. Het kwartet uit München mixt psychedelische krautrock en fusion jazz. Dat ging behoorlijk trippy, zoals op dit nummer Apotheosis van Web.
Dit was het behoorlijk ingetogen XUY uit de nieuwe Belly Up EP van Moin. En dat is nog altijd het samenwerkingsverband tussen het donkerder dan donker elektronica duo Raime en percussioniste Valentina Magaletti. Die nieuwe EP komt binnen 2 weken uit. Het aantal jonge, beloftevolle Britse bands is intussen niet meer te tellen, maar zolang het goed klinkt, blijven wij ze opvissen. Hier is nog maar eens een debuutsingle, Written in Pink van Bang Mary.
Go
En nog een Ierse band in deze uitzending, de derde op rij al, For Nina. Het is de vierde single van dit trio uit Dublin. We draaiden Hounds. Veel is er nog niet uit. We zijn benieuwd hoe dit verder gaat. Volgens het trio Lifeguard moet het blijkbaar eerst slechter gaan voor het weer beter wordt. Dat wil ze ons toch laten geloven op de nieuwe single van hun nieuwe plaat Ripped and Torn. Die komt op 6 juni uit bij Matador. Voor de productie van die plaat gingen ze aankloppen bij Randy Randall van het scheve noise duo No Age. Dit is die nieuwe single It Will Get Worse van Lifeguard.
We'll be right back.
The System, de nieuwe single van Casual Hex, het New Wave Postpunk trio uit Seattle. En dat is een eerste kennismaking met de nieuwe plaat Zigzag Lady Illusion 2, die uitkomt via Youth Riot Records op 13 juni. Nog minder vrolijk klinkt het bij Dead Things. Het trio uit Preston, Groot-Brittannië, schreef al een hele catalogus over ijzingwekkende verhalen uit eigen streek. Niet bepaald de beste city marketing die je kan wensen voor de bewoners, maar zo krijgen wij toch een lugubre inkijk in het verleden van Preston. Op een nieuwe EP Rum Do krijgen we onder andere de verhalen van Buck Ruxton, een arts die veroordeeld en vervolgens opgehangen werd voor een dubbele moord in 1935 op zijn vrouw en het dienstmeisje van de familie. John Simpson was zo nog een geval. Hij vermoorde zijn aanstaande vrouw op hun trouwdag dan nog. En dit is dit nummer, John Simpson van Dead Things.
On her wedding day, by her lover John Simpson, in the Walter Scott Inn. Up at 15, he was 23. She went into the Bluebell pub and had one last.
My heart bleeds.
creepy moordverhalen in adres Dead Things, hier met John Simpson. We gaan eruit met het Koreaanse Suopeo Yenyang. Ook al zijn er al verschillende releases onder die naam op de muziek na, is er niks over te vinden. Eenmansproject of band, het blijft een gok. Net als bij Dive Tank Zonet. In ieder geval klinkt de nieuwe EP weer fris. De basis blijft shoegaze en daar worden parlando, ruige gitaar uithalen en andere zonvreemde elementen aan toegevoegd. Hier is nog Exit Music van Suopeo Yenyang. Veel plezier met Sterrenplaten zometeen en tot volgende week.
In praise of idleness. A great deal of harm is being done in the modern world by belief in the virtuousness of work, and that the road to happiness and prosperity lies in an organized diminution of work. First of all, what is work? Work is of two kinds. First, altering the position of matter at or near the Earth's surface relatively to other such matter. Second, telling other people to do so. The first kind is unpleasant and ill-paid. The second is pleasant and highly paid. The second kind is capable of indefinite extension. There are not only those who give orders, but those who give advice as to what orders should be given. Usually two opposite kinds of advice are given simultaneously by two organized bodies of men. This is called politics. The skill required for this kind of work is not knowledge of the subjects as to which advice is given, but knowledge of the art of persuasive speaking and writing, i.e., of advertising. Throughout Europe, though not in America, there is a third class of men, more respected than either of the classes of workers. There are men who, through ownership of land, are able to make others pay for the privilege of being allowed to exist and to work. These landowners are idle, and I might therefore be expected to praise them. Unfortunately, their idleness is only rendered possible by the industry of others. Indeed, their desire for comfortable idleness is historically the source of the whole gospel of work. The last thing they have ever wished is that others should follow their example. From the beginning of civilization until the Industrial Revolution, a man could, as a rule, produce by hard work little more than was required for the subsistence of himself and his family, although his wife worked at least as hard as he did, and his children added their labor as soon as they were old enough to do so. The small surplus above bare necessities was not left to those who produced it, but was appropriated by warriors and priests. In times of famine there was no surplus. The warriors and priests, however, still secured as much as at other times, with the result that many of the workers died of hunger. This system persisted in Russia until 1917, and still persists in the East. In England, in spite of the Industrial Revolution, it remained in full force throughout the Napoleonic Wars, and until 100 years ago, when the new class of manufacturers acquired power. In America, the system came to an end with the Revolution, except in the South, where it persisted until the Civil War. A system which lasted so long and ended so recently has naturally left a profound impress upon men's thoughts and opinions. Much that we take for granted about the desirability of work is derived from this system, and, being pre-industrial, is not adapted to the modern world. Modern technology has made it possible for leisure, within limits, to be not the prerogative of small privileged classes, but a right evenly distributed throughout the community. The morality of work is the morality of slaves, and the modern world has no need of slavery. It is obvious that, in primitive communities, peasants, left to themselves, would not have parted with the slender surplus upon which the warriors and priests subsisted, but would have either produced less or consumed more. At first, sheer force compelled them to produce and part with the surplus. Gradually, however, it was found possible to induce many of them to accept an ethic according to which it was their duty to work hard, although part of their work went to support others in idleness. By this means, the amount of compulsion required was lessened, and the expenses of government were diminished. To this day, 99% of British wage earners would be genuinely shocked if it were proposed that the king should not have larger income than a working man. The concept of duty, speaking historically, has been a means used by the holders of power to induce others to live for the interest of their masters rather than for their own. Of course, the holders of power conceal this fact from themselves by managing to believe that their interests are identical with the larger interests of humanity. Sometimes this is true. Athenian slave owners, for instance, employed part of their leisure in making a permanent contribution to civilization, which would have been impossible under a just economic system. Leisure is essential to civilization, and in former times, leisure for the few was only rendered possible by the labors of the many. But their labors were valuable, not because work is good, but because leisure is good. And with modern technique, it would be possible to distribute leisure justly without injuries to civilization. Modern technique has made it possible to diminish enormously the amount of labor required to secure the necessities of life for everyone. This was made obvious during the war. At that time, all the men in the armed forces, all the men and women engaged in the production of munitions, all the men and women engaged in spying, war propaganda, or government offices connected with the war were withdrawn from productive occupation. In spite of this, the general level of physical well-being among unskilled wage earners on the side of the Allies was higher than before or since. The significance of this fact was concealed by finance. Borrowing made it appear as if the future was nourishing the present. But that, of course, would have been impossible. A man cannot eat a loaf of bread that does not yet exist. The war showed conclusively that, by the scientific organization of production, it is possible to keep modern populations in fair comfort on a small part of the working capacity of the modern world. if, at the end of the war, the scientific organization, which had been created in order to liberate men for fighting and munition work, had been preserved, and the hours of work had been cut down to 4, all would have been well. Instead of that, the old chaos was restored. Those whose work was demanded were made to work long hours, and the rest were left to starve as unemployed. Why? Because work is a duty, and a man should not receive wages in proportion to what he has produced, but in proportion to his virtue as exemplified by his industry. This is the morality of the slave state, applied in circumstances totally unlike those in which it arose. No wonder the result has been disastrous. Let us take an illustration. Suppose that, at a given moment, a certain number of people are engaged in the manufacture of pins. They make as many pens as the world needs, working, say, 8 hours a day. Someone makes an invention by which the same number of men can make twice as many pens as before. But the world does not need twice as many pens. Pens are already so cheap that hardly any more will be bought at a lower price. In a sensible world, everybody concerned in the manufacture of pens would take to working 4 hours instead of 8, and everything else would go on as before. But in the actual world, this would be thought demoralizing. The men still work 8 hours. There are too many pens. Some employers go bankrupt, and half the men previously concerned in making pens are thrown out of work. There is, in the end, just as much leisure as on the other plan, but half the men are totally idle, while half are still overworked. In this way, it is ensured that the unavoidable leisure shall cause misery all round instead of being a universal source of happiness. Can anything more insane be imagined? The idea that the poor should have leisure has always been shocking to the rich. In England, in the early 19th century, 15 hours was the ordinary day's work for a man. Children sometimes did as much, and very commonly did 12 hours a day. When meddlesome busybodies suggested that perhaps those hours were rather long, they were told that work kept adults from drink and children from mischief. When I was a child, shortly after urban working men had acquired the vote, certain public holidays were established by law, to the great indignation of the upper classes. I remember hearing an old duchess say, "What do the poor want with holidays? They ought to work." People nowadays are less frank, but the sentiment persists, and is the source of much of our economic confusion. Let us, for a moment, consider the ethics of work frankly, without superstition. Every human being, of necessity, consumes, in the course of his life, a certain amount of the produce of human labor. Assuming, as we may, that labor is on the whole disagreeable, it is unjust that a man should consume more than he produces. Of course, he may provide services rather than commodities, like a medical man, for example, but he should provide something in return for his board and lodging. To this extent, the duty of work must be admitted, but to this extent only. I shall not dwell upon the fact that, in modern societies outside of the USSR, many people escape even this minimum of work, namely all those who inherit money and all those who marry money. I do not think the fact that these people are allowed to be idle is nearly so harmful as the fact that wage earners are expected to overwork or starve. If the ordinary wage earner worked 4 hours a day, there would be enough for everybody, and no unemployment, assuming a certain very moderate amount of sensible organization. This idea shocks the well-to-do, because they are convinced that the poor would not know how to use such leisure. In America, men often work long hours, even when they are already well off. Such men, naturally, are indignant to the idea of leisure for wage earners, except as the grim punishment of the unemployed. In fact, they dislike leisure even for their sons. Oddly enough, while they wish their sons to work so hard as to have no time to be civilized, they do not mind their wives and daughters having no work at all. The snobbish admiration of uselessness, which, in an aristocratic society, extends to both sexes, is, under plutocracy, confined to women. This, however, does not make it any more in agreement with common sense. The wise use of leisure, it may be conceded, is a product of civilization and education. A man who has worked long hours all his life will be bored if he becomes suddenly idle. But without a considerable amount of leisure, a man is cut off from many of the best things. There is no longer any reason why the bulk of the population should suffer this deprivation. Only a foolish asceticism, usually vicarious, makes us continue to insist on work in excessive quantities now that the need no longer exists. In the new creed, which controls the government of Russia, while there is much that is very different from the traditional teaching of the West, there are some things that are quite unchanged. The attitude of the governing classes, and especially of those who conduct educational propaganda, on the subject of the dignity of labor is almost exactly that which the governing classes of the world have always preached to that which were called the honest poor. Industry, sobriety, willingness to work long hours for distant advantages, even submissiveness to authority, all these reappear. Moreover, authority still represents the will of the ruler of the universe, who, however, is now called by a new name, dialectical materialism. The victory of the proletariat in Russia has some points in common with the victory of the feminists in some other countries. For ages, men had conceded the superior saintliness of women and had consoled women for their inferiority by maintaining that saintliness is more desirable than power. At last, the feminists decided that they would have both, since the pioneers among them believed that all the men had told them about their desirability of virtue, but not what they had told them about the worthiness of political power. A similar thing has happened in Russia as regards manual work. For ages, the rich and their sycophants have written in praise of honest toil, have praised the simple life, have professed a religion which teaches that the poor are much more likely to go to heaven than the rich, and in general have tried to make manual workers believe that there is some special nobility about altering the position of matter in space, just as men tried to make women believe that they derive some special nobility from their sexual enslavement. In Russia, all this teaching about the excellence of manual work has been taken seriously, with the result that the manual worker is more honored than anyone else. What are, in essence, revivalist peers are made, but not for the old purposes. They are made to secure shock workers for special tasks. Manual work is the ideal which is held before the young and is the basis of all ethical teaching. For the present, possibly, this is all to the good. A large country, full of natural resources, awaits development and has to be developed with very little use of credit. In these circumstances, hard work is necessary and is likely to bring a great reward. But what would happen when the point has been reached where everybody could be comfortable without working long hours? In the West, we have various ways of dealing with this problem. We have no attempt at economic justice, so that a large proportion of the total produce goes to a small minority of the population, many of whom do no work at all. Owing to the absence of any central control over production, we produce hosts of things that are not wanted. We keep a large percentage of the working population idle because we can dispense with their labor by making the others overwork. When all these methods prove inadequate, we have a war. We cause a number of people to manufacture high explosives and a number of others to explode them, as if we were children who had just discovered fireworks. By a combination of all these devices, we manage, through difficulty, to keep alive the notion that a great deal of severe manual work must be the lot of the average man. In Russia, owing to more economic justice and central control over production, the problem will have to be differently solved. The rational solution would be, as soon as the necessities and elementary comforts can be provided for all, to reduce the hours of labor gradually, allowing a more popular vote to decide, at each stage, whether more leisure or more goods were to be preferred. But, having taught the supreme virtue of hard work, it is difficult to see how the authorities can aim at a paradise in which there will be much leisure and little work. It seems more likely that they will find continually fresh schemes by which present leisure is to be sacrificed to future productivity.